Welcome to Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
I mean, who wants to have sex with a guy named Bob?
Oh, Bob. Just doesn't sound right. Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh,
Bob. Bob. Bob.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
That's Jaime. Protege of mine. Ranked number 32 in the federal prison system.
32?
That's right.
Out of what, 20?
We also have a special guest we'll get to later in the episode, so stick around for that. We're at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle there is CriticsPod. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. We'll read a review on the air if you write one. And share with your friends. Let people know where you're from, where you're listening to us, and that you like us. Because not many people do like us.
And those that do, it's begrudging.
It's his confidence in the show.
Just, I'm basing that on nothing. I just figured, who would like me? But if you do, we do have the t-shirt is officially available. I figured out a way to cheat the system and get, Photoshop at a discounted rate because my wife's a teacher and there's a teacher discount. Well,
ooh.
Not using it, but I am. So I was able to design it properly and it's up and it's for sale. I do not know how to give Patreon supporters a special code at the moment. It is on sale for the time being, and what I may end up doing is, similar to the mugs, after a few months, sending a t-shirt. If you have design ideas, especially if you'd buy it, if you're just going to give me design ideas that you're never going to buy, don't waste your time. But let me know, and we have, I don't know, there's things that, yeah.
I finally have. Okay, do you remember the very beginning of the show? We're talking like 5 years ago here. I was talking about doing like a promo image where we used Photoshop and recreated the Lethal Weapon 3 poster with you guys flanking each other and me in the back as Joe Pesci. I think that is a t-shirt idea. Now, I know that I would at least wear it. It's a matter of finding the right, the right image.
See, the one I want is that I've been thinking about is Old Boy moment, and just a picture of Josh's shocked face. Just that face. Yes, get that picture. Put it on a shirt with Old Boy moment above it and a question mark.
I really want Cousin Jeff to draw a picture of our logo, but put Sean in there.
Sure, yeah.
Part of me would consider paying him real money to do that.
Oh, yeah.
The other part of me is like, then I have to buy the shirt, and that's... Not like they're cheap.
Jeff, just remember, take about 15, 20 pounds off, please.
That would be amazing. But yeah, shirt ideas, especially if you're a Patreon supporter and you would want one after a few months of being a supporter, let us know. But you can go to our merch store, which right now is just that shirt. And actually, they put it on mugs and whatever else you want it on. It says Lord of the Fitbit, Fellowship of the Steps. I should have put Even the Trees Walk. That was funny.
That was great. Much appreciation to the quote, whoever posted that. That was fantastic.
But you can get it on a pillow. It doesn't have, I was going to put our logo on there somewhere, but I'm like, you know what? We could actually probably sell this to Fitbit people. So maybe I'll just leave it off for now. But it's up. IHateCritics.net, and then click on the merch store icon up at the top menu if you want to. One of our t-shirts, and there will be more as I have time to make them, and hopefully someday I'll be able to do the Lethal Weapon thing. I'm not sure how we'd go about doing that, but
I know this is kind of tangential, but I'm wondering why nobody's ever thought to maybe do like a charity walk where you set up those things where you have a TV in front of you and you can walk on the, what do you call it, the it's
tarmac.
No, it's just walking in place, basically. What do they call those things?
Jesus Christ.
Treadmill.
There we
go.
You walk on a treadmill, but you walked on a treadmill the entirety of the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oy.
It'd be a pretty good charity walk, wouldn't it?
It would be. Boy, what the, what the actual trip like length is.
Like 9 hours on a treadmill.
That's like three March of Dimes walks. If not more.
And if you're really dedicated, watch the extended editions.
Oh, wow.
That'd be a pretty important charity. But yeah, I hit Crick Sutnut and click on the merch store if you want that shirt. And I'll occasionally put it on our Facebook page and...
What would be worse torture, I guess, is the, watching the movie or the walk? I'm kidding, I'm kidding.
This show hates Lord of the Rings. It's
not entirely true. We just make fun of it. I think all the getting stuff's out of the way, so let's move on to the news. We'll start with, I guess we'll start with the National Board of Review and the Gotham Awards.
Yeah, I know you hate this, Bob. Yes. It is award season. And it does, I mean, we were talking about movies before. It does cut down on what you plan on watching. You know, it helps you call the herd of things you might not want to spend time on. But the National Board of Review is always the first ones out. And they surprised a lot of people today by picking Green Book as the best movie of the year. It surprises me a great deal because Green Book... is a good movie.
We'll get to it.
It's a good movie, but best movie of the year? No. Now that was the one and Viggo Mortensen also won Best Actor, so a couple wins there. But A Star Is Born actually took home three wins.
That doesn't surprise me.
Best Director for Bradley Cooper, Best Actress for Lady Gaga, and Best Supporting Actor for Sam Elliott. All good signs for them going forward. For the Academy Awards, Regina King won Best Supporting Actress for If Beale Street Could Talk. So, you know, lots of wins there. And First Reformed got a big win as well with the Best Original Screenplay for Paul Schrader. And, of course, that movie also one of the big winners at the Gotham Awards yesterday. But the top 10, they release a top 10 every year, and the top 10 for the National Board of Review includes The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Black Panther, Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is a big, big win for that movie. Eighth Grade, First Reformed, If Beale Street Could Talk, Mary Poppins Returns, another big surprise. A Quiet Place is another big surprise. Roma is a foreign film, and then A Star Is Born, also getting a nomination for the NBR. And then, of course, for the Gotham Awards, which came out today as well, the Best Feature winner was The Rider, which thrusts itself into the Academy Award race. I thought it was already there myself. I really like that movie a lot. Chloe Zhao's independent film, but also the First Reformed, Beale Street Could Talk, and The Favorite gets in on that one, which is another one people have been talking about with Emma Stone and Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz. That one's getting a lot of buzz as well.
Interesting. I think the National Board of Review picked the wrong horror movie. Not that Quiet Place is bad, but there's a better one out this year.
There is a better one out there.
but people didn't get it, so that's fair.
It'll be interesting to see now what A24 is going to do now with Hereditary, because now they've got
First Reformed
has entered the race pretty heavy. So it'll be interesting to see what decision they're going to make now in Hereditary.
And then early buzz on Aquaman says it's better than Wonder Woman.
Early buzz on Aquaman is really strong. Yeah, the couple of reviews that popped up early stated this is the best DC movie yet, which, other than Wonder Woman, isn't saying much. But I'm not sure. I mean, these are the early industry critics, so we're talking probably Hollywood Reporter and Variety.
But they would put, I mean, a lot of people put Wonder Woman up against most Marvel movies, though.
Right.
So that's why it's kind of
that's why it's a notable. That's why we're bringing it up, yeah.
Yeah, and Wonder Woman's in my top five superhero films, period. So that would be a big, big victory, at least for fans of that particular franchise, if Aquaman actually was that good. I keep watching that trailer, and then I see Jason Momoa and Dolph Lundgren in there, and I start to get very scared, but... If it is, then great. If you bring out the best in all of them, okay, that's all we could ask for.
I'm still suspicious, but who knows?
Well, yeah, and sometimes it's hard to separate the landmark of what Wonder Woman is from the movie, and the same with Black Panther, and maybe if that they're trying to do that here. I don't know, but maybe it's just kind of like Iron Man, just a fun, easy-to-watch movie, because I don't really know where the social impact from Aquaman's going to...
Pay attention to the seas. Maybe there's a scene where they show all of the plastic congealing over Atlantis or something like that, you know?
It's an environmental thriller.
Yeah, save the whales.
It puts First Reform to shame. It's an environmental thriller.
That would be amazing.
Al Gore's got a special cameo.
The Lion King released a teaser. Jon Favreau directed live-action Lion King.
Live-action is a funny way to put it.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Live-action, it's all CGI. It's all social CGI animals. I mean, I guess live-action is what we have to call it, right? But
not a cartoon.
It's not a cartoon, so...
I saw something that said it was more of a reimagining than a live action. Like, Disney specifically in their release was talking about the reimagining. And, okay, so they're kind of admitting that it's more of a complete CGI thing. I don't know about locations in the film. Based on the trailer, I don't know if they've got anything real there. That would be slightly disappointing because the Jungle Book does have some humans involved in some actual locations. I will say this, though. It did kind of trigger in me that emotion that I feel for the original. It's a masterpiece. I love watching it no matter how many times I go back to it. So if they capture that, sure. I mean, they've already got our money. They've got our money so many times, in fact. The DVD release, the VHS originally, the Blu-ray 3D.
The Lion King 2.5.
Okay, no, I've never seen any of those, nor will I. But you've got the right idea. I mean, we knew this was coming. Everything is coming. Aladdin is going to be next year as well. So, okay, we'll just sit back and let it happen to us, I suppose.
But why skip over The Little Mermaid? At least go in order. I know, but at least go in order.
Oh, okay. I see.
And also, why not wait 20 more years? I don't know. It looks just like the cartoon, only modern. I mean, it looks like similar shots, the same song, the same voice for some of them.
Well, I mean, if you watch online, you can see the trailers lined up, and it's pretty much a recreation of the original trailer, even though they're calling it like reimagining, which they've recreated the entire trailer.
Which they kind of do with Beauty and the Beast, and it makes me wonder what's the point. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, the point is the stock price. Well, the Disney stock price every time they announce one of these.
Right. And I love Jon Favreau, and I'm good for him. You know, I'm sure he'll do a great job making it look cool. But in terms of artistic, you know, point, what is it? I don't think there is one.
I'm starting to wonder if these are. I mean, certainly for me, they're starting to run their course. I mean, the last one, Jungle Book, didn't do anything for me.
Well, yeah, but Jungle Book's also a smaller story. Beauty and the Beast was huge.
I mean, I liked Beauty and the Beast, but I've forgotten about Beauty and the Beast. Cinderella was really amazing. Good. That one I'll never forget. But they also did a lot of stuff with that.
That's not like a recreation, a reimagining. It's kind of its own thing, almost. This Beauty and the Beast is almost a shot for shot remake. This looks like it's going to be a shot for shot remake.
If there's a criticism to be had of the animated film, though, it's a little too cutesy.
Taylor Thomas.
No, I've already, last week, in fact, I kind of praised his performance, but a different flavor to it. Okay, so you've got Donald Glover instead of Jonathan Taylor Thomas, a Chiwetel Ejiofor instead of Jeremy Irons, voice inflections and whatnot can do a lot. And I'm just thinking that it will be a slightly more mature reimagining.
Seth Rogen is instead of Lathan Lane, so really mature.
You've asked me to take him seriously on this show, and so I'm trying.
It's a rated R Lion King. That would be fantastic.
Hakuna Matata, yeah. Indeed.
For Seth Rogen, yes.
But yeah, I do vote that we don't watch like 15 versions of The Lion King going into this. Because I was definitely burnt out on Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Definitely should have seen the movie first, then gone back to it. It would have been more enjoyable that way.
I still say the French version of Beauty and the Beast was amazing.
It's the best of the three, I'll give you that.
All right, let's get to our new movies this week. And we're not going to go in any particular order because we do have a special guest here to talk about the first one. Do you want to go through our versions for our...
Yeah, our reviews first.
All right, Creed 2, also known as Rocky 8.
I'm not sure. I don't
Rocky
know.
Rocky 8.
I don't know what the numbering is, but Creed 2, this is a Of course, coming off of the first one where Adonis Creed is now fighting for the championship as soon as basically the movie starts. Although it doesn't start with him. It actually starts taking a look in Russia with Drago and Drago's son. We get kind of an early look at him, and the movie almost appears to be about him at the start. And I was kind of turning my head. But then finally they do get in the action. And I like the fact that the championship fight is right up front. They're putting that right out there. He's going to be fighting for the championship right away. And then because that gets that idea of him becoming a champion out of the way early, and we can focus on him as a character. And I really enjoyed that choice. But I enjoyed a lot of the choices in this movie. Stephen Caple Jr. is a smart director who really meets this stuff out very, very well in terms of building points of Adonis Creed's life and character. And the way he employs each character, I loved the way he used Rocky. The way that Stallone performs in this movie, the elegant use of him, the deployment of him as a plot device, especially during the Drago fight, the first Drago fight, is exceptional. It really is. I was rising and falling with him as much as I was with Adonis Creed. Stallone is so amazingly comfortable in this role. He knows how to play this character. It's in his face. It's in his bones. It's in his every movement how to play this character. And it's risen from being, you know, that initial first Rocky where he's an amazing actor to it's gone to being a joke, and now it's back to being this amazing character that he just knows how to play in his very being. And I adore this character now. I adore him as this character. I want him to be awarded again for this character. That's how great he is. The movie progresses, of course, and there is a I thought maybe, you know, the one thing that I'll always give Rocky IV is that training sequence just kills. Everybody gets into that training sequence.
A sequence? You mean a third of the movie?
But this movie, the training sequence in this movie is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. The kid sitting next to me in the theater, I thought he was ready to fight somebody. Watching that, he was throwing punches in his seats. And I started getting into it too. That mixture of hip-hop and symphony that they're doing in the soundtrack is perfect. Everything about the scene is set beautifully. I really like this movie a lot.
I hated it. No, I was really impressed that I was thinking Rocky IV. I was ready for the cartoon Creed movie, which I was perfectly fine with. And it wasn't the cartoon movie. They took a cartoon in Rocky IV and made it somehow real, which was really impressive. Part of it has to do with Dolph Lundgren aging and having stubble and whatnot. But the other part was just, you know, you're really sequeling Creed and not making Rocky VIII, even though I don't know. The way they tie it all together is really perfect. It really is kind of Rocky II through IV, mm-hmm. You know, a callback. And it's just, it's not, you know, like a Force Awakens remake, but there's enough nostalgia there so you get that. Because Creed didn't really have the nostalgia as much as this one does, but it's not enough that it's distracting. It's still its own thing, and it's just really, really neat. And then to find out that the best parent of all of them is Drago is even another neat thing. And that scene where he does be a good parent is pretty phenomenal.
It really is. I got to give him that.
It was way better than the "you can change, everybody can change" ending of Rocky IV. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. My wife and my daughter went because I was waiting to go see it with my niece who loves Rocky. I'm glad I didn't because the fight scenes were way more brutal than the other Rocky movies, I thought. So it might have been a little much for her, but they ended up going with me and they both liked it way more than they thought they would. And they actually both cried. But back to the fight scenes, that was the best boxing, or the neatest, the way they did that to the camera was really, really cool. I haven't really seen a movie do it like that before, definitely not a Rocky movie. And it really was effective. You know, you didn't have to see Drago missing Rocky by a foot and have him falling backwards.
Yeah.
Just an overall really, really good movie. Stallone did a great job writing it. The director was fantastic. Michael B. Jordan, we haven't even mentioned his name yet. The star of the movie. You know,
very effective. Very strong, and to the point where he's allowing everybody else to look good.
Right. And, you know, Rocky IV is a cartoon. This, he has to look like he can beat Drago in this. And he holds his own, and he does. And the love interest is girlfriend and the fiancée in the movie. She's great in it.
Tessa Thompson's pretty amazing, yeah.
Felicia Rashad is really good as his mom. I don't know. I was really surprised at how much I liked it because I was ready for Rocky IV too.
There's a lot of solid things about it, and I'll agree with you on that. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite rise to the level of the first Creed, nor does it exceed it in any way. And so that part's slightly disappointing. You want to capitalize on it. And Michael B. Jordan is the actor that I want to go see his movies more than anyone else at this particular moment, because he's just, there's so much behind his eyes. There's so much behind his facial expressions. And he does a really good job with what he has here. He's vulnerable in this movie. You can kind of see that he needs some guidance, even though he's super tough. He's the champion of the world, you know, but he still needs some guidance. And the movie takes time to actually form his character a little bit more, instead of a guy that's just fighting opponents now and all we do is see him in the ring. That would be unfair to him. We see him develop as a husband, you know, as a father as well, and he's trying. Okay, I get that. That's good. And Tessa Thompson is an excellent supporting character. Her music in this is kind of interesting too. All of the music in the movie has got a particular rhythm to it that I really dug, especially her song that she sings or performs or whatnot before Adonis goes out to the ring for the final match. Whew, that's good stuff. I like that a lot. There is something a little awkward about the dialogue in this movie. I'll pin it on not Victor Drago, not the Florian Montagne. I can't remember what his name is or how to pronounce it or whatnot. There's just a little bit of awkwardness going on there. And scenes that don't quite hit, the scene between Rocky and Drago in the diner, that should have
was Pacino, De Niro, Heat, man. See,
that's what I would have wanted. Just to, having it hit just a little bit harder. I mean, Rocky's playing this character to not any extreme, right? There's no super lows, super highs. He's pretty even keel the whole time. But if I was seeing like my mortal enemy, you know, for the first time in 30 plus years, I might look at him a little more intensely than he does. Yeah, it just doesn't quite rise to the level that I was asking for it to be. But the fight choreography is the best fight choreography I've seen in a boxing movie before. Be that the camera, be that the direction, or the fight, the fighters know how to do it now. You know, it's clear that Michael B. Jordan is bigger and more in shape, and there isn't, other than height, there's not that much of a mismatch there. So it's believable what they're doing. And that's always what I'm looking for in sports movies alone, not just boxing movies, is how they move and does it make sense. And the killing blows in this movie, not killing literally, but the TKOs or whatever the case may be, those hit really hard, and they work so much because we're into the fight, you know, and it makes a difference when they do it well. The last 5-10 minutes of the movie I thought was the best part. I enjoyed that the most. The flipping back and forth between two different stories there at the end and wrapping that up well. It is surprising to me that Drago is trying really hard to gain respectability, and that's, if looking through his eyes, that's how you would do it from where he came, is trying to do that. And the cameo in this movie is really, it doesn't really matter to the story too much, but I thought it was a lot of fun that they did get that cameo in there. I had to do a double take and think to myself, wait, is that really who I think it is? Oh, it is, it is. And I lean over to this poor guy and say the same thing, but I enjoyed it. It's just, it's kind of like a second tier Rocky movie. I'll put it with 2 and 3 before I would say 1 or Creed, or I like Rocky Balboa a lot more the second time that I saw it, for example.
I'll put this ahead of Rocky Balboa, but kind of in that. To me, it's Rocky, Creed, this.
Absolutely.
Balboa right behind it. I mean, 4 is so much fun, but it's kind of in its own little world. It's 3-2. I mean, it's hard for me to take the cartoons and put them with these. Mm-hmm. Before we get to our special guest, there was something I really liked, was that, if anything, this is an homage to Rocky III the most, except for there's no, they don't do the Eye of the Tiger thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason he loses is because all of a sudden it hits him. He's the champ. He's got to live up to his dad. It all kind of hits him at once while he's in the ring, and he's not focused anymore. He can't get it out of his own head, and he gets beat. When he comes back to fight at the end, he finally knows who he is, and he has, you know, it's not about not wanting it versus not wanting it. It's about living up to the pressure of being Apollo Creed's kid or be the champion. He didn't even realize he was a champion when he won the belt right away. Mm-hmm. He was talking about his car, which is kind of a fun homage or flashback to the first movie. But the way they captured that and the way that they never once said the word phrase Eye of the Tiger was very made me very happy. But two, that they didn't even go there, and it was his own story, really, you know, helped me, impress me.
To the point that you made before about what it does for number four is that you're probably not going to take that seriously because it is a cartoon, but what it takes is the part about Creed's death, Apollo Creed's death, and makes that so much more important and impactful. And there was thought that maybe that part of it would be kind of weird and cartoony, and they wouldn't land that. I thought they landed that beautifully. It makes you miss Carl Weathers so much. I so wanted him to be a force ghost in this movie.
But he's going to be in The Mandalorian. You're close.
But he had a presence in this movie.
He did. Just, he really did. It was beautifully done. It's a really lovely tribute to him.
And I think, you know, not to argue with Josh's point on the restaurant scene, I'm neither here nor... It wasn't a Pacino De Niro scene, even though I know that probably was the first thing you thought too when I thought it.
I don't often think that when I think of Dolph Lundgren, but yes, I know what you mean.
Or Stallone. But in order to keep it from a cartoon, you know, you say Mortal Enemy, and I think that was the way it was, and they had to do a lot of work to make Drago not a cartoonish bad guy. But I thought they succeeded with that. But again, that wasn't the dramatic scene that we're going to be talking about 30 years from now. All right, we have a special guest. You want to introduce him, Josh?
Yes, this is my boy Ben. He's been on the show before, way back in 2014, when Mr. Peabody and Sherman was a brand new film, and he got about 5 minutes on the air then. But this past week, he spent, oh gosh, it had to have been roughly 11 to 12 hours watching 6 Rocky films. He had seen the first Rocky back in 2015 and then watched 2 through Creed this week. And so last night we went to see Creed 2 together. And so this poor guy has sat through 7 boxing films this week. And I imagine he's going to land a much better blow the next time he punches me in the shoulder.
You know what's crazy about that, though? 7 Rocky movies. It's still less than 5 Lord of the Rings Hobbit movies.
You know what? That's a really good point. Now that you say that, oh, wow. So anyway. For 3 Lord of the Rings, you can get 7 or 8 Rocky movies. But my question is, what did you think of Creed 2?
It definitely wasn't one of the best of the Rocky movies, but it wasn't one of the worst with like 5 and 3.
Yeah, and since you watched all of those, is there a particular order that you would put them in, what your favorite would be, what your least favorite is?
My favorite is definitely the original, and least favorite is definitely 5.
That's good to hear. I'm glad a kid likes the original. My niece is, I turned on to Rocky 4 because it's easy to watch, and then I made her, we watched like 4 times because she'd come over and wanted to watch that, so I said, all right, we're going to watch Rocky. And she's thinking Rocky IV, so I put the old one on. She tried so hard to pretend to like it just to impress me. But I'm glad that you liked it.
What did you think of Rocky IV?
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah? Did it make you want to throw punches?
A little bit.
Yeah, we do have a pair of boxing gloves at home, and I used to have a heavy bag. The stuffing kept coming out of the top of it because, you know, look at me. Of course. No, I'm kidding. But I need to get a new one because it's such a fun thing to do. You see it in the film, and it immediately makes me want to throw some myself. And I graduated from hurting my wrist all the time to throwing punches the right way. And there was a brief period of time when I was 25, 26 that I really wanted to get into it. But that never happened. And that's a good thing. I only have half brain damage.
Rocky IV always made me want to do sit ups like off of something. We had a table.
Nothing has ever wanted me, made me want to do sit ups.
We had a table in our basement. My brother and I would take turns sitting on each other's legs and like hanging off tables. And then doing the sit-ups he does off that balcony thing or that loft or whatever he's on.
How many people have broken their necks trying to recreate that?
Of course.
They were all under 12.
While Hearts on Fire is playing in the background.
So, Ben, what stood out to you in this movie? What did you enjoy?
I enjoyed seeing Ivan Drago again.
Very cool.
Was it, having seen Rocky IV so close to this, was it awkward how different the character was in Rocky IV versus now?
Yeah, definitely.
Did it work from Creed II? Did you think they pulled it off, or was it more distracting?
I feel like they did a good job with Ivan Drago, but I wasn't a big fan of Victor Drago.
He's a fitness model by train, so that's what he does for us. This is his first movie. I thought at the very least, the one scene that he does, the one big dramatic scene he had, I thought he was at least effective in that moment.
Yeah, if nothing else, between Ivan and Victor, they at least pull off Russian to a believable point. And that was something that I always wondered, like, in Rocky IV, you've got Bridget Nielsen and Dolph Lundgren trying to speak Russian, and it just never quite got there for me. And in this particular one, it's like, oh, okay, well, at least they tried a little harder. Dolph Lundgren, I've learned a lot about him over the years, that he's actually a really smart guy, and he has a lot of thoughts. He just doesn't always orate them very well. But I think from 2011 or so, we used to play this game called Rocky Legends on the PlayStation 2. And you might know the game I'm talking about.
Spider Rico, yeah.
Yes. And all these characters that we came across that I would show you, like Clubber Lang and Drago eventually and Apollo with his American flag shorts or whatnot, it had this particular lore behind it, this legend of, oh, when you're old enough, we got to watch them. My question to you is, and be as honest as you want, you're not going to offend anybody here, did it live up to the promise of the Rocky movies that I'd kind of held up for you, or were you slightly underwhelmed? What do you think?
I would say I definitely liked them a lot, and it did live up to what you said.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to stop watching Lord of the Rings movies now?
He was going to say except. I want to hear what his except was.
Well, you still have one more Lord of the Rings movie to watch. Mm-hmm. That's coming up pretty soon. Don't worry. Mortal Engines comes out in a couple weeks. So.
But you were going to accept what were you going to... It lived up to...
I would say all of them lived up to it except for 5, which just is a bad movie. And Rocky Balboa was good, but just not my favorite.
I'm with you on that. With you on 5 all the way. That movie is terrible.
Oh, yeah. Everybody terrible hates movie. 5. I think even Stallone hates 5.
Now, of course, the greatest Rocky character of all time is Thunder Lips. Did you like Thunder Lips?
Hulk Hogan?
I don't even remember those.
Do you know who Hulk Hogan is?
Yeah, we're not a big wrestling family.
Parenting fail.
I know, but do you know who Babe Ruth is? I mean, he is that known.
Okay, so Hulk Hogan is the Babe Ruth of wrestling, but like the fake wrestling. You know, I'm sorry, I said fake. I didn't mean to, folks. But he's the guy with the blonde hair that tore his shirt off. Hulkamania, you know, back with Roddy Piper and all those guys, the Macho Man, Randy Savage. And that's when I watched a little bit. And I never have introduced you to this whole WWF, WWE thing. For a reason, it's not something I'm really into, so I wouldn't pass it down. But you may enjoy it eventually. But no, you won't. But he's in... he's in... Thunderlips is in the beginning of... Is it 3 or 4?
It's 3.
3.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Which he did say he didn't like 3. So... Or you had 3 with 5. Earlier you said 3 was one of the ones you liked a little less. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
But Clubber is still cool. You like the like pitying Clubber. Of the fool. Yeah.
Paulie's the best, though.
Well, and the robot. Don't forget the robot.
I asked him, what did you think of the robot? And you said... It was awkward. Weird. It was weird. Yeah. He's used to all these high-tech robots like Johnny Five, you know, so, and Ultron.
It's like, this is like a Chappie-level robot, like one of the worst.
Oh, sad face.
He He hasn't seen Chappie yet.
Is there anything else that Rocky fan number one and critic would like to interrogate the boy about?
Will you revisit it ever, or are you done? He's moving on.
I think it'll be a little while, but I would definitely watch them again.
I don't blame you watching all of them at once.
He's a little punch drunk. It's a term for, yeah, never mind, you know. Okay.
No, but I think it's impressive to, I mean, it would be hard for me, I can't imagine watching it at that age, because they, especially from like 5 to Balboa, they just, so much time passes, and then they try to change the tone of the previous movies, and especially when Creed comes out, you know, a lot has to, you have to just kind of accept things. All of a sudden, you know, Rocky's the best of all time in, you know, the mid-Rocky movies, but by the time Creed comes around, Apollo's the best of all time. And Rocky, you know, Creed 2, now Drago's, you know, he's not this monster anymore. He's just a, so there's a lot to, that would be hard to do and to accept. So that's pretty impressive that you're able to do that. It's very cool.
Another thing I want to mention that's good about this movie is it did make me think about Drago in a way I'd never thought of him before. And like, what was his inner life? What was his life in Russia like? And I, you know, I never really kind of considered that before. And the fact that I never even thought about him being Ukrainian. And there's a whole political background to him falling out of favor and having to get a real job. And that's that was really interesting, the way that they laid in that backstory.
And I did think Brigitte Nielsen mattered, because when she, what happens at the end, I think it's pretty important to that fight.
I agree.
It is, especially, like, you can see Adonis has got the people that he can see through the ropes and whatnot, and Victor is looking for a little bit of help. He tries to see what he sees, and there's nothing there for him. It's a little empty, so it's almost as if they're saying, like, family gives you the edge in a fight like this.
But as silly as that sounds, I also had no idea where this fight was going to go. I mean,
yeah,
they could have killed him. He could have. I really did not know how they were going to end the movie, and that's, I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, that was really good.
Okay, well, thank you very much for once again dealing with me and being on the show and watching all those boxing movies. So you are released.
All right. Ralph Wrecks the Internet.
Yes, Ralph Wrecks the Internet. I adore this movie. This is one of my favorite movies of the year, but it's one of those that's so personal to me that I don't know if I can actually communicate just how much it means to me. Because it hit me in a very unique way that I did not expect this movie to do. The idea here is that Vanellope, Sarah Silverman's character, her game gets broken, Sugar Rush. And Ralph just figures out, hey, we'll go on the internet and we'll find the part and we'll save your game. And they've established early on, of course, that these two have a pattern of everything that they do, the way they do it. And Vanellope's kind of getting tired of the patterns in her life, whereas Ralph is perfectly happy where everything is. They go on the internet to try and find it, and Vanellope finds this new space, this game called Death Race or something, whatever it's called.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, and she finds that this is a really, actually a pretty great place for her. She loves racing, she loves the danger, she loves the excitement, and she's really great at it. And she kind of finds a new place that is away from Ralph, and Ralph has got to come to terms with the idea that maybe his friend might have other friends. And that idea, that notion of learning how you respect someone else's dreams over time, and the desires that you have, they matter, and they matter to that person you care about, but they also, you know, you have to respect what they want as well. And that learning that respect for another person is something that is so beautiful to teach a child and so well taught in this movie. It's really such a beautiful message. And of course, then you've got these great big jokes that are going on throughout the entire movie. Ralph's brilliant, viral YouTube videos and the internet parodies, the, you know, Bill Hader's character popping up and as a pop-up ad. There's so many really inspired moments, but then you get to this wonderful ending that is all about insecurity and about, it's built literally on insecurity, which is such a wonderful thing. I love this movie so much. It's actually right behind Hereditary as my favorite movie of the year.
It is such a smart movie. The way they use the internet, the one that tied into the story, but it's so perfect the way you look at how they did the internet. The pop-up stuff's amazing.
Yeah.
The dark web's great. The viruses are great. And it, but it's not just that it's funny. It's like really, really good. And it's just kind of it kind of shows kids how the internet really is. This is what it's really out there. When you're out there doing stuff, this is what it's like. And I mean, the it wasn't Google, but the basically the search engine guy, he was hilarious too. But yeah, it was just really, really smart. The my problem when I saw it was that my son was he wanted to see it really bad, and he was going to Disney World the next day with my in-laws, and he'd woke up this morning, and I thought that morning, and I thought it was just kind of dry in the house. His throat was all croupy.
Yeah.
But it got worse throughout the day. So by the time we were in the theater watching it, he was really struggling keeping his breath and stuff. So it really was hard. It was just, I don't know. The movie was very good. And then at the same time, you're dealing with him trying to get through the movie. We saw the ending, but you know how then they kind of finish the story after it ends. We missed that. We had to finally go. He's like, I can't do anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what happened after that. But I don't know. I just really... It was just a lot of fun. I really liked Wreck-It Ralph a lot, the first one. Like, to me, that's one of the better animated movies of all time, and I have it a lot higher on my list than most people do. And this one's right there with it, if not a little higher for me.
It's higher for me.
But yeah.
Sad face. As much as I love snow and love the winter, it couldn't have happened on a worse possible day to have an incoming blizzard and whatnot, because I had planned on spending all Sunday at the theater, and even on Thanksgiving when family members of hers wanted to go to the theater, I was kind of like, yeah, that's all right, I'm going to be at the theater a lot later on this weekend, and it didn't happen. So it just goes to show you, if you have a Thanksgiving week, just escape, go to the theater, do it, you might be snowed in. I feel really bad about this one. This is the kind of thing that I would definitely have seen opening night. And last night, if the roads hadn't been goofy and if I could have kept the special guest up until, you know, past midnight or whatever, I didn't know that there was no school today, or I probably would have gone for it. There was a 10:40 show that I could have taken him to. But oh, I will see this week. We're already planning on it.
Yeah, it's a must-see. It's brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. And I did not expect it to be as good as it is, but I also didn't expect this message to hit me the way it did. It just reminded me of a friend that I have who, you know, I tried, you know, I feel like I kind of imposed my idea of our friendship onto her, and then, you know, learned over time that to respect what they wanted, and it was so personal to me, and it's rare when a movie can speak to you that personally.
Yeah, it didn't really speak to me personally per se, but it really is a perfect movie, and because the way they use the internet is so smart and cool, and then to mix that story in here, you know, it really is kind of in a way, you know, a Gone Girl enemy type smartness and just perfect use of all that, and no weak links, no fat. It's just really damn near a perfect movie.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny. And I should point out, it is very, very funny too.
Oh yeah.
They took 6 years to make it. And that to me says something there. I mean, it's rare that you have an animated film that's so successful, or any film that's so successful that has franchise possibilities or sequel possibilities, that isn't cranked out almost immediately. So I'm interested in the genesis behind this movie, how they decided to go ahead and do it, because the first one was wildly successful. It wasn't like it was struggling for cash and they had to wait and see if it caught on. It took their time, and I wish more people would do that with franchises.
And while you don't need the first one, having the first one matters, because their friendship going into this movie, really having that first one there makes it that much more important, and you have all that backstory. You're really going to like it. I think you're going to be a big fan of it. It's certainly the animated movie of the year, for me at least. It sounds like for Sean, too. go to Robin Hood.
Top five John C. Reilly?
Now.
Okay.
All right. Top five John C. Reilly. Let me pull the internet up here.
Put your top five. Who's your top five?
All right, top five John C. Reilly. The reason I'm recording on a Tuesday night is that someone told me they were going to do a top five list that they've never really participated in a top five before because they actually thought they could do it this week, and they never did it. We waited for him, but now it's too late. We have to record. He knows who he is. We'll start with Cousin Jeff. Number five, Guardians of the Galaxy. Number four, we need to talk about Kevin. Three, The Good Girl. Two, Chicago. One, Boogie Nights. Michael Carlson. He has the Dr. Steve Brule Memorial List. Is that how you pronounce it? Reed Rothschild, Chess Rockwell, and Boogie Nights. Cyrus, number two. Three, Cedar Rapids. Four, Cal Naughton Jr. and the Ballad of Ricky Bobby. And five, Step Brothers. I've yet to see the Sister Brothers, Dan and Ollie, or the new Sherlock Holmes. He may be the actor I'm most excited about who is working today. Uncle Jeff has five, What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Four, The River Wild. Three, The Prairie Home Companion. Two, Magnolia. And number one, surprise, surprise, The Hours. I didn't do a list per se. I just kind of listed movies. The Wreck-It Ralph movies. Boogie Nights. We need to talk about Kevin. I do like Talladega Nights a lot. And then Cedar Rapids is... Oh, and Guardians of the Galaxy. Josh?
I have... Because I don't have it screenshot this time.
Well, I can read it for you if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
Number five, Tim and Eric. Awesome show. Great job. Steve Brule is good, too good to ignore.
For your health.
Four, Wreck-It Ralph. Three, Magnolia. Two, Boogie Nights. One, Guardians of the Galaxy. An honorable mention for The Love of the Game, Never Been Kissed, The Perfect Storm, and Hoffa.
For The Love of the Game, really?
Well, it's a bit role. I love like characters like him, you know? Gus Sinski, the wayward catcher that can't hit a lick, you know? But he's on the roster anyways.
He's playing Ron Karkovice.
Oh, shit. That is perfect. That is the most, the number one most equitable real-life player.
I don't know. Yeah, I love John C. Reilly. I've never... all the big ones that people seem to like, Step Brothers or Walk Hard, I'm not a fan. Talladega Nights, I hate, outright hate that movie.
Love Talladega Nights.
but then I also happen to love Chicago. I think that's one of the best performances of his career. Boogie Nights, Magnolia is incredible. I love Magnolia. I would say Wreck-It Ralph, and especially Ralph Breaks the Internet, is my favorite thing he's ever done.
All right, let's move on to Robin Hood.
Robin Hood. This movie is terrible. This is so bad. Why did they make this movie? The Robin Hood, of course, is the Robin Hood story, but they've kind of updated it and added arrows that can break stone but not bone. I don't know. I don't understand it either. They've got, like, rocket arrows, I guess, in this movie. Somebody on YouTube, a brilliant critic, was pointing out... They were calling it Zero Dark Locksley because there's the Crusades. The Crusades are basically the Iraq War with arrows. They've got flanking maneuvers, and they've got... They've got the arrow gun is up in a tower, and Robin's got to figure out a way to get up there and be the sniper who takes out the guy with the arrow gun. And they're all wearing this like leather outfit. Even 300, 400, 500 years before leather was invented, they're all wearing these leather outfits that are made that make them look like the modern army wear. So it's really so. I could not stop laughing at the costumes throughout this entire movie. Ben Mendelsohn is basically wearing this like $1,500 leather duster throughout the entire movie. He looks like a complete dork. And he's basically playing the same character he played in the Star Wars movie, which is so stupid. Why did you hire this guy to play that role again? It's so bad. This movie is so bad. Everyone in it is bad. The story is bad. Jamie Foxx is bad. I hate this movie.
What about compared to Prince of Thieves?
Prince of Thieves is way better. Way better. Aside from Bryan Adams, it's way better.
Bryan Adams was fine.
Prince of Thieves has a lot of particularly like interesting moments, things that have actually lasted through time. The score, for example, is something that has been adapted by other trailers, and Disney used it for their video introductions for a long time. The height of the Michael Kamen score. I didn't understand why this existed. There's a lot of Robin Hood films, but this one in particular really befuddled me. As franchise capabilities go, I mean, do they leave it open for more?
They do. Ugh. It's a sequel tease, and it's just the thing of it is that this is basically an origin story. Like, they don't even get to Sherwood Forest until the end, and then they're in Sherwood Forest, and then we find out the big reveal of there's a different sheriff of Nottingham, a new sheriff of Nottingham,
Alan Rickman. No,
I wish. That's the only thing that's lasted from this is at least his line. I'm going to cut your heart out with a spoon.
They say that in this?
No. Oh. No, but I'm talking about, in terms of things that lasted, like that line is way better than this movie.
That line is good because of the way he said it.
Now, what I was really excited about with this movie, does it bury Taron Egerton? Since he can't open a movie, clearly, does this mean he doesn't get any more starring roles? Because that would make me very
happy.
He's
not going to star in the next Kingsman movie.
I saw that as well.
Holy shit, $100 million budget?
Yeah.
$15 million
so far. Currently being called the biggest flop of 2018, money-wise.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know what it's done internationally yet.
It only has a total of 20-some million. Mm. And with the $100 million budget, there's just no way.
Wow, Rocky already beat its budget.
Yeah, first weekend they topped the budget there.
Wreck-It Ralph had a $175 million budget. I'm sure they'll eventually get there.
Oh yeah, they'll blow that out of the water.
Yeah, record weekends for both Creed and Wreck-It Ralph. Mm-hmm. It's pretty incredible. All right, The Front Runner.
The Front Runner. This is Jason Reitman back in theaters for a second time this year after Tully, which we you and I both love.
Yes.
And he's made another one here called The Front Runner. And this is kind of, it's not necessarily in the vein of Thank You for Smoking, but it's kind of got that seriousness, but also a bit of a snark to it as well. Not from the Gary Hart character. Hugh Jackman plays it pretty straight, but the kind of the media characters have that sort of attitude about it. And they're developing. It's like developing that attitude. It's like before we actually all became snark, this is the movie that's like the precipice of the beginning of snark, where we all started hating each other and saying mean things to each other. This is back in that time when the media actually liked politicians and pretended to just look the other way on their personal lives, and this is when that changed. Gary Hart was running for president in 1988, and in 1987, after he had announced, he was expected to be the next president of the United States. He was up on George H.W. Bush at the time by about 12 points when he announced, which is a long time. There's still plenty of time for that to fall apart, but he was the presumed winner of everybody. And then this all came about where he went on this boat called Monkey Business. He was hanging out with a woman he'd already met, by the way. Donna Rice, he already knew her at that time. He'd met her at a party at Don Henley's house about a year earlier, interestingly enough. So they knew each other. She somehow ends up on his lap. They take a picture. That's not in the movie, but that's how the story actually played out, was the picture came out, and that's what really sank him. But the movie plays out with the reporters. He basically made this huge mistake where he told reporters to follow me around. If you want to know what's going on with me, you can just follow me because I'm not doing anything. You're going to be pretty bored. So they did. And, well, here's what they found. Donna Rice leaving his house, or entering his house, and they didn't see her leave. Now, he has a back door in his house, so she could have left through the back door. We don't actually know what happened between them, whether she spent the night or not. It's assumed, and you know, certainly that's kind of where this is where it's that beginning of cynicism. It's that beginning of a worldwide distress. Not that Watergate's obviously where that starts, but in terms of delving into people's personal lives and making it personal like that, this is kind of where it really the media and the politicians kind of take a turn. And I think Jason Reitman really captures that extraordinarily well. And Hugh Jackman is really great in this. He plays Gary Hart very straight. He's got all the aspects of the Gary Hart that you've seen in interviews, and the mannerisms are down, and that self-seriousness. He doesn't have a sense of humor. He doesn't. There's no behind the scenes Gary Hart, and in front of the cameras Gary Hart. It's all played very straight, and I really liked his performance a lot.
Do they play dirty laundry in this?
They do not.
Is that what the song is about?
No.
It's, okay.
It came out beforehand, but it goes hand in hand.
It's kind of, yeah.
Kick them when they're up, kick them when they're down.
Now, I remember hearing Gary Hart's name in 1988. My mom thought he was quite the looker.
My mom, too. She loved Gary Hart.
But as a very staunch Democrat, she was saying, well, that doesn't mean I'm going to vote for him. She would out loud say that because my father was conservative. So he was backing Gary Hart all the way, and I think begrudgingly ended up voting for Bush. But I definitely remember hearing that name all the time in the House. It's Dukakis. It's Hart. It's Dukakis. It's Hart. Whoever won that, we all lost.
I have no memory of any of that.
When did you first notice a politician?
I mean, it was right after that, Dukakis Bush. Yeah. I didn't, literally probably right then, but just right after he sat on her lap or vice versa and went away. Green Book.
Green Book, the movie that the National Board of Review has said is the best movie of the year. This is based off of a true friendship. A guy named Dr. Don Shirley was a musician in the early late 50s, early 60s. And he's about to go on tour of the South. And he needs a bodyguard slash driver. So he hires this guy named Tony the Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen. Viggo Mortensen's put on some weight, so he's kind of chubby, but he's a tough guy. He's not a mobster, but he's kind of in that world. He works at the Copacabana, but the Copacabana is being renovated, so he's got about 3 months where he needs some work, and this kind of fits perfectly for him. So he gets hired, even though he's kind of racist himself, and he's going to go on this journey of learning to understand this guy, and it's about race relations. And I know, Bob, you're kind of thinking this is going to be cheesy. The Mahershala Ali.
Seen it.
You saw the movie?
Yes.
Okay, so you did think it was cheesy.
I love this movie.
I liked it a lot, too. I thought it was really charming.
Feel-good movie of the year. I will say feel-good movie of the year.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the way this is played out. Viggo Mortensen is quite good, and Mahershala Ali is amazing in this movie. He captures the aspects of this character that in such a unique way. This is a very singular performance. I've never seen Don Shirley perform or anything. I listen to his music a lot now because I wrote my review listening to it, and I've been listening to him a lot, just having him out in the background because he's so amazing. But I don't know what he's like as a person. I've never seen it. But the way Mahershala Ali captures the mannerisms, he creates this very unique character. So whether it is him or not, this is how he's going to be seen from now on. Because it's this amazingly indelible performance that is so unforgettably just this character. It's brilliant. Viggo Mortensen is kind of playing a lot of the typical, hey, Italian guy stuff. But, you're going to do that in a movie
like this.
But
they're also going to. The character he's playing is now officially going to be this guy.
it's a very strong performance, and it doesn't get limited by that hey Italian guy stuff.
I will say the trailer had me kind of wondering if he was going to be the trailer kind of me. That was the character I was looking at going, I don't know, from the trailer. In the movie, it's not as distracting. It seems real and authentic. That's the guy he is. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah, he grows into it.
Right. No, but it's not a groundbreaking movie that's going to, I don't think it should be winning awards per se, but it is, I went and saw it like at 10:30 at night, tired, and this movie kept me awake and interested, and I was along for the ride. It's a lot of fun. It's a very easy movie to watch. I just really, really liked it. I thought everybody in it was good, but it just kind of, it's that next level down from, the best movies of the year. It's mm-hmm. kind of more the feel good, fun, good level. But at the same time, it really does capture, how a racist can, really become good friends with someone of the opposite race. And
mm-hmm. I think one of the things that is a Green Book's advantage in terms of awards is that it's one of those movies that everyone can agree on. Whereas other great movies, like, say, Hereditary, for instance, divide people. And there are people on both sides, detractors. The Favorite has the same issue, where there are a lot of people who really love it and a lot of people who really don't. Green Book just makes everybody happy, and that's why it kind of settles into the awards. That tends to happen with the National Board of Review. Movies like The Post, I think, was a NBR winner last year. It's a movie that everybody can agree on.
And it's definitely safe, but at the same time, it's safe in a smart way. Mm-hmm. Like, they do stuff with the cops here that I think is the right way to handle it, because it's the accurate way to handle it.
Right.
They didn't necessarily take a stand. They, you know, just kind of presented it the way really it really is. And just the way Viggo Mortensen, the way their chemistry together, the way it grows is really authentic and just very cool. And it's kind of a lot of fun, you know. I hate to say this, but I mean, it's kind of, you know, some of those buddy cop movies we grew up with. It's kind of like, I mean, just Riggs and Murtaugh in a lot of ways. It's that much fun to watch them interact with one another. And then when something bad happens, the way they deal with it, and it's not super predictable. It's not, I mean, it's predictable, but it's not, you don't roll your eyes at it, really. Mm-hmm. You just kind of go along for the ride, and it's not even gentle and pleasant. It's just kind of, it's there. It's kind of, it's just, you agree. I think that's a very good way of putting it. No one's going to watch this and go, I disagree. No point are you rolling your eyes, but at no point is it really challenging either. It's just kind of a good movie that people should see, but it's just that, a good movie.
And the two words, you said it twice, authentic, and that's what I was only concerned about when I watched the trailer, is it comes off as perhaps slightly inauthentic, and I'm glad to hear that on both sides of your reviews, and I think I definitely will see this now. I can tell you it was brought up to possibly see this past weekend as well, and I heard somebody in the room say, you want to go see that Green Room movie, and I was thinking, boy, you're going to be very disappointed if you see Green Room instead of Green Book, or pleasantly surprised.
And when I read Sean's review, I thought about this a lot, because you mentioned kind of wanting to see it from the other perspective. It really is Viggo Mortensen's perspective on, and I just kind of wonder how that would work. You know, I'm curious. I don't know that I'd like it better per se. He's definitely the better actor here and the better character. But I'm just curious, and I'd like to see it just to know if for nothing else. That really did have me thinking. I'm wondering how you would do that, and I think, I mean, it was directed by Peter Farrelly.
Which, yeah, that was.
What else has Peter Farrelly done?
He's one of the Farrelly brothers.
Farrelly. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought you said Farrelly specifically.
I did say Farrelly. I don't know how to pronounce that name. Okay. But yeah. If, I don't know. That kind of shocked me more than anything else did.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have much insight on how that worked with the brothers, or how, why it was just one of them this time, or I don't know. Maybe one of them was comedy and one of them wanted to do something serious. I don't know.
Definitely was like nothing they've done before.
Sure, sure. But they're always, I mean, they're solid directors. They've always been, you know, able to, even as weird as their movies can be and outlandish as they are, they've always been good directors. You know, they at least maintain a tone very well, and that's certainly something that this movie does really well.
And then Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yes, this is Melissa McCarthy's Oscar bid, which did get a pretty big boost from the National Board of Review, giving it a nomination. Melissa McCarthy plays a woman who's was a successful writer at one point. She writes biographies, and now she's not very successful, and she's struggling to write. And she comes across a way of making money to try and keep her apartment, where she found this letter by a person that she was writing about, Fanny Bryce. And she takes this letter to a shop and finds out that it's valuable and makes a couple bucks off of it. And it occurs to her that this was written on a typewriter, and if she had just the right typewriter and was able to get that signature just right, there's a key moment where somebody says to her in the movie that, you know, if this letter were just a little bit more personal, it'd be worth more. And she knows this character well enough, this Fanny Bryce person well enough, to write in her voice. She's that talented. And so she begins to mimic that voice in a letter, and then she figures out how to use the signature. And she starts this thing where she's faking these letters. And it really does expose this very weird industry of autographs in a strange way. Because, you know, there's that, always that question you always have if you didn't see the signature yourself. Is that real? And this movie really puts that to the test for you. Melissa McCarthy's really great in this movie. She's a very solid performance. She really melts into this character. She's... She's not lovable at all. She's not a nice character, but she's a very real character. And I really bought into her. Richard E. Grant plays her sort of friend in this movie. I guess they're kind of friends. They really are. They're kind of just sort of people who, they're kind of leftover people who kind of end up in each other's lives and like, well, there's nobody else around. That's kind of the friendship, and I kind of liked that dynamic between them. I also love that there's this minor character in the movie who kind of she looks at and sees maybe perhaps a different kind of life that she could have had at one point. And that was really underlined kind of the sadness of this, as much as it's kind of darkly comic at times, that touch of sadness really is what makes the movie. And that really there's that's throughout the movie too, is that little sadness, that pathetic part of her life that is very compelling and it's sympathetic even.
And I watched this one as well. And I guess, you know, going back to Green Book, I found, you know, that's a very watchable, safe movie. This probably deserves to be on the level above that, but I found it really boring and just hard to stick with it. I thought everything you said was true. I don't know. It just wasn't as, it didn't connect with me. It just, I found myself drifting out of it a lot. Melissa McCarthy's great in it, but at the same time, I just was starting to, the trailer was enough for me to kind of already have this movie. I didn't need much more than the trailer to, and I don't, but again, at the same time, I can see why, you know, people like it and whatnot. It's a little more challenging. It's a little more hard to watch. It's a little more, there's more to it. There's more depth. There's no, you know, that's not, she's not a likable character. There's more to it than something like Green Book is. So I don't know. I guess that's kind of my two cents on it. I was shocked at how bored I was by it. And my wife, and maybe it was also my wife was really bored by it. And sometimes when you're with someone else, yeah, they can rub off on you as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed Classic.
Our Undisputed Classic is Stripes by Bill Murray. Yes, yeah. We haven't talked about Bill Murray yet, but you'll see why in a little bit.
Stripes is our classic this week. Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, and the couple of losers join the army and continue to be losers, I guess. I don't know. I hate this movie. I hate Stripes so much. This movie is not funny. To me, anyway, I just don't laugh at all. I hate Bill Murray in this movie. I hate his character. I hate Winger. I don't think Winger's funny. I don't think he's cool. I think that the opening scene, I thought he was just a dick. I know he's supposed to be a funny dick. I know that's his character. I just thought he was a dick. And I just didn't care about him at all. And it never got better. He was just, I thought he was a jerk the entire movie. And I just, it just never came to be where I thought he was the cool jerk. I just thought he was a jerk.
I don't follow. You know what? I saw it for the first time this week, as well as a movie we'll get to in a bit. And knowing as much as I do about Bill Murray, I think if I'd started with Stripes, I might feel the same way that you do, because his character isn't very likable. That's for sure. You, unless you're kind of in love with the Bugs Bunny rebel type of character who's always messing things up just to mess things up.
But Bugs Bunny, I mean, is a better character than this. This is not a great example of the Bugs Bunny character, because Bugs Bunny was rarely just a jerk.
Bugs Bunny type of character. Yeah, that's the best word that I could come up with. But I envisioned the making of this movie was far more fun than the final product. You've got Ivan Reitman and Harold Ramis and Bill Murray and John Candy, all of these comedic minds working together, and a lot of this seemed off the cuff, which is what a lot of Bill Murray stuff is to me. It's like this couldn't possibly have been scripted. It's him doing something with a line or doing something with a character, a little tick or whatnot. And in a way, this his experience, he's got an arc here. He does start out as somebody that's difficult to enjoy, even though I wish I would have done the same thing to this woman because she was being a total asshole. yeah, he shouldn't have done that. Okay, but tossing the keys off of the bridge and whatnot, that's magnificent.
But, I mean, he was being a prick first. I mean, I know she's a stuffy rich lady and we're trained to hate stuffy rich ladies. He was a dick from the first moment she walked up.
So he's got a bit of an arc here. So then he he loses everything. He gets his car stolen. His girlfriend breaks up with him, rightfully so.
She
because
was absolutely right to do it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All of this is going against him, and so he thinks that he's going to get out of it by joining the army, okay? And so he drags Harold Ramis with him because people that are this age, I don't want to just say boomers, but I see this so much in the personalities of people that are the age of Bill Murray. Not everyone, okay? But I know a lot of parental age people that are like this. They're like, yeah, I joined the army because, I don't know, the grocery bagging business sucked. And so that's how they got into it. And it did whip them into shape a little bit to the extent that Bill Murray's character does, to the point where he does something actually positive in this movie towards the end. His interactions with the drill sergeant, which isn't nearly as severe as Full Metal Jacket, but still serious, and Sergeant Hulka, which is a great name that I'm going to remember, okay? This movie was fun to me. I enjoyed it. It didn't necessarily make me laugh out loud, but I envisioned the behind the scenes with all those people interacting off of the camera to be a fun time.
I expect that to be a better time. I wish I was watching that instead of this movie.
Yeah, and I, as you guys have often witnessed, I bring so much to a movie based on what I already think of the people involved. That certainly helped my experience of it. Also, with it being streaming on Netflix, that helped too, not having to pay for it this time. Yeah. I kind of get it. It made sense to me, and it was fine, not great, but I'm glad that I saw it. It gives me another angle to Bill Murray's career as a guy that really does just come up with stuff on the fly.
Not to try and take apart what you said, but I didn't see an arc with him, because the problem that he solves at the end is a problem that he caused. I mean, so in terms of an arc, I mean, I don't know if it was much of an arc, but that ending is so stupid.
He never solved anything until the end. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like the movie we're going to get to, which is Scrooge. And the reason I had constantly for years have been saying Josh is going to love this movie. And then as I'm watching it, I'm sitting there and I know Sean hates Stripes, so I'm watching Scrooge and I'm kind of like, okay, I could see why someone would really hate this movie, because I know a lot of people don't like Scrooge. And I watched Stripes right afterwards, and it's kind of in a lot of ways the same thing. He's playing a horrible character with that much of an arc, just kind of something happens at the end. But there's something about Bill Murray that he just kind of, he's fun to watch if you want it to be. But that's kind of, you have to bring it to that, I guess, in a way. But I'm with you. I think Stripes is lesser than, like, say, Scrooge or Groundhog Day or Caddyshack or anything else. But I do think Stripes – did I say Scrooge or Stripes? I don't remember. Stripes is lesser. Yes. I think Scrooge is a more.
Agreed.
But I do think it's fun enough to watch here and there, but not – I don't think it's as much of a classic as people act like it is.
No, absolutely. No. In the same way, and I don't like Animal House, for example, or Caddyshack, but those are on the level of classics in a way that I heard Stripes as part of that conversation from people like my parents that would say, oh, when you get older, you can see Stripes and Caddyshack, and Meatballs even is another one that they would bring up that has Bill Murray in it. I don't know if that one's good or bad or not, but it was enjoyable enough. Now, the other thing about it is we'll get to Scrooge in just a second. So should I just go ahead and start with it?
1988.
Okay.
number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
We'll lead with that one. And Richard Donner directs this one. It's basically the Scrooge story set in 1988 modern times. And Scrooge is now a broadcasting executive who tries to get Scrooge. Okay, the first 5 minutes of this movie had me like almost rolling on the ground laughing. I bought the movie sight unseen because it's a Black Friday sale. It was $6, okay? To rent it, it would be $3 or $4, depending on how you look at it. So I just went ahead and said, forget about it, and I got it. And I'm so glad that I did. I really like Scrooge. there's some awkwardness. There's some choices that maybe they didn't have to make. Okay, but I've seen Richard Donner's career now on most of the scope of it. Some of it's like, oh, you missed on everything here. Some of it is you missed on most of it. Like Conspiracy Theory, for example, is one that he missed a lot on.
Fantastic movie. Anyway, I have no memory of that movie.
But he's kind of like a really poor man's great director. I don't want to call him a carpenter, and I also don't want to call him an auteur. He's right in the middle for me. I love Superman so much, and I love Lethal Weapon so much, and this one is like number three
right there
for me. It's right there. But the spoofs that they do in this one with Lee Majors, the night the reindeer died. And Father Loves Beaver. That's the one that got me.
That was a joke I never got till I was watching it as an adult. I'm like, oh.
I mean, I didn't know what was coming. Then all of a sudden, Father Loves Beaver.
I know your father. He's out chasing Beaver.
There's a lot of uncomfortable moments in this movie, but mostly it's Bill Murray doing a riff on this whole thing, and that's what works for me. This is him balls out energy, despite the fact that a lot of it is negative. Now, character arc is a poor mathematical term. I'm sure that somebody that's better at math and remembers their geometry, I do not, would tell me that it's more of like a straight line and then a real quick loop.
It's like the Grinch, yeah. Or Scrooge. I suppose in Charles Dickens' version, it's kind of less similar.
Just. Right. In all of the family members that he has in here, I think his brother Andy or something like that plays his brother. Brian Doyle Murray plays his dad in this one. You got all the Murrays. Karen Allen plays her usual, like, kind of thankless, but she's got such a winning smile that you love to see her on screen. It's just a whole lot of fun, and I see myself revisiting this one a lot.
Every year.
Yeah, it was an experience, we'll just put it that way.
I loved the ghost, too, at least.
The second ghost in particular, Carol Kane, the ghost of Christmas Present, is magnificent, constantly just beating the shit out of him. I mean,
it's a toaster.
Now, I saw that, and I said, oh, my number one Christmas boutique gift item, a toaster from Ghostbusters. Yeah.
And I like David Johansen as the ghost of Christmas Past as well.
I call, in my mind, I first thought, is that Buster Poindexter?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. He was originally in the New York Dolls, and he changed his name to Buster Poindexter.
Oh, later on, so it is the same dude. All right, well, I feel a little better now.
Yeah.
But in the ghost of the future, like, it's not played by a person, but boy, that's an effective, creepy ghost, man. And even the makeup that they do on John Forsyth also is pretty great, too. I mean, it's not just strictly makeup. It does it really well. And I guess to be impressed with a Richard Donner film, I know what's going on here, and this is one of his better works.
This is really the only watchable Christmas movie for me. I really hate Christmas movies, but I love this movie. I do. I love this movie. I think it has a terrific arc, and I think this character is much better established than Winger, because Winger is not meant to be a villain. Frank Cross is early on. He's the villain of this story, and you know this is the Scrooge story, so you're aware that he's a bad guy from the start. So whereas Winger, you're assuming he's a hero in stripes. He's not. He's just a jerk throughout, and you're kind of disappointed in him the whole way. This movie, he's meant to be a villain who learns a valuable lesson going through, and I thought that was exceptionally well played. And this is one of Bill Murray's best performances. He really is the full Bill Murray, and he gets to be a real jerk, and he gets to kind of go through something where he earns back his humanity, and I really dug it. Bobcat Goldthwait is hilarious in this movie. Elliot Loudermilk is everyone. I love that. I love the ending, the blowing a raspberry on his stomach killed me. That was so great.
I can't imagine anyone but Bobcat Goldthwait in that role, because knowing who he is and what he's like and everything else that I've seen him, to try and hold it in for a good portion of this movie as the straight man, that works really, really well.
When he busts in singing Christmas songs and firing a shotgun, that is fantastic. That is just beautiful.
I will say that. I mean, when I was watching it, worrying that, you know, I might have pumped this up too much for Josh, Bill Murray is not consistent. Like, in the same, within a sentence, you know, he's being, you know, trying to win Karen Allen back and then trying to staple antlers to a mouse. I mean, it's, there's no consistency there at all. But it doesn't matter at all because it's Bill Murray and he makes it so watchable and fun that, like, it's just nonstop a fun movie.
I love the way he does those turns. I thought that was a brilliant choice on his part to make that turn from being kind of sweet and nice to being a complete
dick.
For
comedic purposes, yes.
I thought from a comic standpoint, that was a wonderfully well-told and great choice on his part.
But I could see critics hating that because of the lack of consistency of the character and not taking the movie. I mean, because it's not a movie to be taken seriously. No. And really from those trailer commercials.
It establishes a very broad tone from the very beginning.
Right. Especially when he has a Scrooge trailer.
That is amazing.
He killed an old woman. This is great.
No, but it really is probably the most quotable movie that I have around the house. I mean, I don't use the hammering line much, but on occasion. But if I were in charge, and I am, is probably the thing I say more than anything else. And I usually follow with the ear flick. But
and those mice upstairs look like they're in quite a lot of pain with those antlers on their head.
Yes. They're dead, but
the analysis for a solid, it's a whole scene. The analysis of whether or not the nipples are visible from the dancers. It's incredible.
You can hardly see them nipples. And these guys are really looking.
That's what it was. Yep. So, I think you've got my comedic sensibilities nailed, because this one and Used Cars, for example, is another one that I was on the floor with that one. And so somewhere in between Naked Gun and Scrooged is where I lie.
It's like, I was wondering when the beaver line came up. I was like, Josh is going to love this. He loves beaver lines.
I do. I'm a very...
Anytime somebody says beaver.
I'm a very simple man.
Josh loves beaver.
A good steak and a nice beef.
What else came out?
Oh God, it goes downhill from here. There are two films that I didn't see, and I can't remember the title, but Gene Hackman and Terry Garzin, one of them has to do with water and a romance or something like that. It looked whimsical, but didn't make very much money, like south of a million, and so it doesn't bear much mentioning.
Gene Hackman was the kind of the Samuel L. Jackson of his day, where he was in a movie a month.
Yeah, it appears that way. Bat 21 last month. Also one called Buster, which I remember on the video shelf because I remember looking at my parents and saying, if Phil Collins is in that movie, we should watch it. No, probably not. Stars him and Julie Walters. He plays one of the characters from the Great Train Robbery in this one, and it follows him in his notoriety in England. I know nothing of just, this particular character.
Just that it's incredibly boring. It's an incredibly boring movie.
Does it have good Phil Collins music in it? That's what I was curious about.
You've heard
about.
Take Me Home?
That is my favorite Phil Collins song.
That's what's in. That's where it came from, this soundtrack.
Wow, not bad.
But you saw the video, so you're good.
Yeah, that's pretty much all.
Okay, there we go. Also, Cocoon the Return.
Phil Collins song. Anyway, continue.
What about Phil Collins? I didn't hear you because I was hacking.
So that's your favorite Phil Collins song?
Yes, I love that song.
Not Hurt in the Air Tonight?
Well, that would be in the top five, yeah. But no, Take Me Home.
I thought for a moment you were marveling that somebody had a favorite Phil Collins song.
I mean, I love me some Phil Collins and some Genesis.
See, I would go Genesis, but I'd probably stop at the Peter Gabriel era.
Of course you would. Once they start like hitting mainstream, you're like, I can't like that shit anymore.
I was too young to. It was just, I like 20-minute songs. Sorry.
I understand. I like the early Genesis too, but
Misunderstanding and Abacab. You can't beat those.
No, you can't. I like those too. Anyways, enough about the Phil Collins. Let's talk about Cocoon the Return. Everybody? No. What I remember most about this, seeing it in the theater.
Did Ron Howard direct this one?
This is directed by Daniel Petrie, exec produced by Ron Howard. And of course, the senior citizens, Wilford Brimley, Jessica Tandy, et al., Don Ameche, are all back. And I can't remember what the plot point is of this, but
I believe it's something to do with like breakdancing and trying to save the community center or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and they've got to go back. They've only got a limited amount of time. Or... no. And Courtney Cox is involved in one of her first film roles, Masters of the Universe, and then this. And she is really gorgeous in this movie and memorable to the point where she became like my new Leah Thompson after seeing Cocoon the Return. Just, and not that that matters, of course, but as a 9-year-old, it's a big moment.
You're the only 9-year-old one that saw the Cocoon Return. But
do remember that's Courtney actually, Cox, that shit should be on my tombstone right there. It makes so much sense.
Were you on like a day trip to a nursing home and they decided to go to a movie that day?
No, my parents were just raising me as a peer. Let's feed them all the adult contemporary music that we can. Let's give them some Fogelberg, have them watch Cocoon and Cocoon the Return. Let's expose them to Alien too early. What's that?
Behind the Beatles record is a Fogelberg record.
Oh, magnificent.
Stole from my parents. 40-year-old, 9-year-old.
And it's all been backwards since then. I'm now 9.
He's listening to Cats in the Cradle from the parent perspective as a kid.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, there might be one other one from 88, but I've forgotten it, and matter. We've talked too much.
How do we manage to take a tour of Josh's life week after week?
I always want to hit on something where the movie like is impacted me, you know, in what other way. And so it ends up being a circular logic. Yeah.
I think this is the most interesting.
It really is. Like, way more interesting than us.
I just
That's
don't...
good. That means that it hasn't been in vain. Because I've been thinking this has been some weird ass shit for like 39 years now.
I just don't like anything, you know. I mean, even Rocky, it's like, yeah, Rocky V sucks. I agree.
Bob has spent his life avoiding hard opinions.
No, I just don't like anything that much. Nothing brings me that much happiness, and it's it says something about
Except
me.
For
and
the
I'm
devil's
a...
rejects. That
yes, nihilism brings me great joy
and orgies.
Yeah. Which well, who can blame you there?
Can I make that happen yet? But... time ticking, I guess.
Next time I pick a classic, Caligula. Oh,
I want that to be my Star Wars.
I'm going
to
change my mind on your New Year's party. Just
You're not coming now?
I'm not coming.
Just keep a backup key in your pocket.
Yeah, there's a fishbowl when you come in. Next week, speaking of orgies, The Possession of Hannah Grace, Boy Erased, which... threesome. I don't even know what that means.
You're doing a, like in your head, you're doing a fuck, marry, kill on Lucas Hedges, Nicole Kidman, and Russell Crowe.
Actually, I was thinking of like couples coming over and erasing the boy. But either way, however you want to do that. And then what was this other one? Mariah. Oh, cool. I said it right.
What is his name?
Mariah?
The animating guy.
Oh, Miyazaki.
That's it. Yeah, I can never remember okay. stuff like that.
Well, that's okay. You
I
can.
Love Miyazaki.
You always get Cerise Ronan?
Saoirse.
Thank you. And I'll always have Miyazaki.
Our undisputed classic is the Eli Roth film, The Last Exorcism.
He produced it. He did not direct it. That's why it's good.
Oh, he's directed a good movie. And then... instead of a top five, because I feel like we're kind of played out, we're not going to get rid of the top five, but we're going to start moving forward with trying to rotate other categories around that you guys can still participate in. But we're going to do movie fights, and because Sean loves The Last Exorcism, which I like it very much too, we're going to fight that against the actual Exorcist movie. And we'll let you guys fight it out on Facebook as well and Twitter and whatnot. And we'll read your comments, and then we'll destroy Sean. Actually, The Last Exorcism is very good.
It's a good idea, though. Our top five was getting slightly stale. We like to rotate our produce on this show, so magnificent. Well done.
After 5 years.
after HBO.
Well, we didn't do it the entire time.
Some things keep well.
We used to do the movie tagline thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right.
And we had one listener. He still listens. Anyway, but that is our show. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. Up here are Key Grip Levels, Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing. Our character actors, Cousin Jeff, Christina Cato, and Josh Paul.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Sarah Ward and Corey from Ivy Envy.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer is Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars are Uncle Jeff and Dave Sievers.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon to be a supporter. And if you want our new Lord of the Fitbit shirt, ihatecritics.net, and click on the podcast merch tab. That's where you can purchase it. And if you become a Patreon supporter, somehow I'll work in our merchandise into that. I am not stocking these shirts. They are through a third party, so any pricing problems, I apologize. I have no real control over it. I'm going to try to keep our margins to a minimum just so we can get more shirts out there and more merchandise so you guys can have it. If anything you like or any ideas you have, let us know on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll see if we can make a shirt out of it or a mug or whatever they make. If nothing else, that's our show. We'll see you next week.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. The three best friends that anyone could have.
I'm happy to skip Flick Chart this week.